Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to a bonus episode of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the TLS's podcast. What you're about to hear is a recording made in October 2018 of An Introduction to the Odyssey, a panel event chaired by the TLS's classics editor Mary Beard in collaboration with the South Bank Centre's London Literature Festival. Who is Odysseus? Why can't he get home? And will the gods help or hinder his journey? Discussing these questions and more are the author and academic Simon Goldhill, Professor of Greek at Cambridge, the memoirist and translator Daniel Mendelssohn, the poet Catherine McCarthy Wolfe, and the novelist Madeline Miller.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to one of the events in the Odyssey-themed South Bank Literature Festival. I'm Mary Beard, and I'm going to moderate these people. And I think I'm doing that in my capacity as the classics editor of the Times Literary Supplement, which hereby gets its plug. The only other thing I should point out to you before we kick in is that there is going to be this edited reading of the Odyssey at 4 o'clock this afternoon in this room, using Emily Wilson's new translation. It's not going to be the whole of the Odyssey. You're not going to be here till tomorrow, sadly.
If you're lucky, yeah.
But I have to say, just to warn you, that if you don't already have tickets, it is technically sold out, so I'm afraid Homer's having a very big day today. I'm going to introduce my interlocutors, starting at the far side with Karen McCarthy Wolfe, who's a poet from London and who was one of the contributors to a Radio 4 series of reworkings of episodes from The Odyssey. Then got next to me, Daniel Mendelssohn, who's a writer and critic who's based in New York, and he's the author of a recent memoir about reading the Odyssey with his father. Here we've got Simon Goldhill, who is Professor of Greek at the University of Cambridge, and he knows a lot about the Odyssey, and as you would imagine. And then we have at the far end Madeline Miller, who's a writer and teacher from the United States and whose most recent novel is based on the character of Circe from The Odyssey. Now, I want to start by just having us dive in a bit, and I'm going to ask my panel in turn just to give us, you know, no more than a couple of minutes on their pitch on The Odyssey, their take, how they first came to it, why it's worth reading, or any combination of those. Daniel, I'm going to you first.
Well, I came to The Odyssey, I think like many people, in high school. I had a wonderful English teacher in high school, and I was already interested in Greek things. And she said, oh, well, you know, you must read The Odyssey. Kids your age love The Odyssey because of all the adventures and monsters and all of that. And so I read it, and I found myself loving that stuff the least. And what I really loved are two things. I would say, here's my pitch. It is the great work about identity, right? The great problem of the Odyssey is here's this guy who's been away from home for 20 years, and he has to prove who he is. And as I always like to tell my students, this is in the era before driver's licenses. And so what does it mean to prove that you are the same person? Anyone who has been to a 10th high school reunion is familiar with this phenomenon when strange people come up to you and say, I dated you, you know, and you think, who is this person? And so I'm joking, but the Odyssey is extremely animated about this question of identity. And the other great thing, of course, about the Odyssey is, and related to the first, is that this is a character who is a great storyteller. Odysseus himself is a master of language, puns, jokes, lies, it must be said, and he forms, you know, what people think they know about him and who he is based on his ability to con them with language. So he's a very appealing character, particularly if you're a writer. He's this sort of original writer in some sense. How is that on 2 minutes?
I think okay. That's absolutely brilliant. What about you, Karen?
Well, you said writer, Daniel, and I suppose for me, I came to the Odyssey as a writer. So sort of less as a like a young kid and much more as someone that was reading it as a writer and thinking about the text. I suppose, you know, when you enter a text as a writer, you're thinking about it in terms of what you might harvest. You know, there's kind of quite a kind of a sort of like vampire-ish relationship with it in a way. But I was also thinking about, I mean, it's interesting that you talk about identity as well, because I was thinking about, I mean, in a way, for me, Odysseus is a character who's, you know, full of huge sort of issues of entitlement. So, you know, he's, you know, to me, I was asked to respond to the Odyssey for Radio 4, thinking about it as a sort of text that might respond to issues of migration in a contemporary sort of sense. But for me, Odysseus is much more the expat than he is the migrant. So, you know, that's maybe how he enters the space. yeah. So I think, yeah. But at the same time, I think that he's this deeply complex character where he is kind of like, I feel like he's moral but not ethical in sort of how he reaches his goal. But at the same time, he's a, you know, and he's charismatic. And I think also he's suffering from the biggest case of man flu there ever was. You know, it's like, hello. Yeah, it was really, 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 really terrible, those 8 years having to sort of like wait it out on an island with the most amazingly gorgeous goddess or goddesses. You know, that was awful. It was horrific. So I like it for its hyperbole in some ways.
Madeline.
So my relationship to the Odyssey goes back to when I was a child. My mother used to read me pieces from both the Iliad and the Odyssey as bedtime stories, which now she thinks makes her sound really inappropriate. But I really loved them, and I was completely gripped by these stories that felt so huge and passionate and exciting. And actually, Daniel, I had the same experience where I thought that the monsters were the least interesting part. I was very engaged in the human story that was being told, you know, this exhausted man who's just trying to get home to his family. I was drawn to it, to study it, and I ended up going on to study Homer and the Odyssey. But I was also drawn to it in the sense that I kind of wanted to get in it. And I wanted to be able to find sort of some of these moments that, as interesting as Odysseus is, he is that original storyteller. And in fact, for a chunk of the Odyssey, he is telling the story. So for some of these episodes, Circe, the Cyclops, this is his version of it that he is explicitly telling. And given that he sort of lies his way across the Odyssey, it would make sense that he would be shaping that narrative and that those characters would be very self-serving to an image that he wants to create, mm-hmm. which to me kind of led me into feeling like, well, how would that look from someone else's perspective? How are these people looking at Odysseus? You know, if we take the Odyssey as sort of his version of his story, how does that story look to other people? And there are all these wonderful characters to do that with in the Odyssey.
Now, I'm going to let Simon off the hook on this particular task, but I'm going to ask him, because he had a go at this in last week's TLS, saying how he came to the Odyssey and writing a large article in the TLS. So I want to get him to do something slightly different, which is to, as it were, ventriloquize the shadowy figure who's also here somehow on the platform with us, which is Homer, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Homer probably didn't exist. And he may or may not have been part and parcel of composing, not writing down, the Odyssey in, let's say, the 8th century BC, just after someone who might also have been called Homer didn't write down the Iliad, right? What I want Simon to do is to be Homer for 2 minutes and give us, just so we're all up to speed, the plot of these 12,000 lines of poetry.
Okay, the Odyssey in 2 minutes. In the Odyssey, Odysseus, the hero, comes home from Troy to his house in Ithaca. The first four books are about Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, who is looking to find his father. We get the house in disarray, the house without a head, looking for its head. In the second four books, we get Odysseus traveling from Calypso's island, where he's been holed up with a goddess for 7 years, as far away as possible from human inhabitation, back to an amazing place called Skeria, where the Phaeacians live, which is a sort of magic Californian mystery place of great beauty, where the trees are always in flower and fruit is always there. So he travels from the place as far away as from civilization to a sort of hyper-civilized place. And while he's in this hyper-civilized place in the next four books, he tells all the stories that we're familiar with from the monster part, the cyclops and the lotus eaters and the giants who eat men. And after he's told those four books, we're halfway through. Book 12, after only 1 minute. The second 12 books take Odysseus home. He arrives on the beach in Ithaca and brilliantly doesn't recognize where he is. It's covered in a mist. He doesn't know what's going on. He's being tricked by the goddess Athena. And the next 12 books slowly take us back towards his inhabitation and his position as master of the household. And he does it through a slow process of recognition, first through a swineherd, who is one of his own servants, and then through his dog, and then through his son, and then through... Finally, he gets to meet Penelope, his wife, and a very long, drawn-out recognition takes place. Before that, he has to kill, or in the middle of his recognition, Penelope, he has to kill the suitors, then fight with the suitors' family, and everything stops with a thunderclap from Zeus in the middle of action. But we know that Odysseus is going to go on traveling. The first thing he says to his wife when he gets back into bed after 20 years is, "This is not the end. I'm about to go away again." And so that's 1 minute and 57 seconds. And my last 12 seconds, I will just point to two of the things that we've mentioned slightly, but are the two great themes in some ways of the Odyssey. Since I'm the professor of Greek, you'll have to forgive me if I teach you one word of Greek today. The first word of the Odyssey is andra, which we can translate as man or a man or the man or person, male, adult. And that introduces the great theme of the Odyssey of what it is to be, not just a person, but a male adult. And it starts with his relationship to his child. It's going to go through his relationship with his mother. We're going to get this extraordinarily complex version of what it is to be a person. And if you think of the journey of Odysseus as a way of discovering about a person, it's really important that journey never ends, that he is going to go away again. There's an extraordinarily open-ended view of what identity might be, which is why it's such a great text. But as everyone's mentioned too, the other extraordinary thing about the Odyssey is the way in which there's so many stories about stories. Just as Odysseus is the original tricky bastard, you ask him the time, he tells you a lie, right? there are so many different versions of how to tell stories about Odysseus. Telemachus travels to hear stories about his father. When Odysseus asks, is in with the Phaeacians, he hears songs about himself. He's already the subject of epic, in his own epic. When he gets back to Ithaca, he tells lies that Homer describes brilliantly as lies like the truth. Right? So we're always in this world of Odyssean language. And it's that combination of how does that great story of identity relate to the great story of how we use language that has made the Odyssey the most extraordinary teaching text for generations and the most extraordinary text about culture for generations.
Simon, thank you. I mean, 2 minutes for the summary and 1 minute for the themes. That was pretty good. Thank you. I would like actually to pick up your first theme now. And you talked about Odysseus, the andra, the man, the hero, people often say in this poem. You called him the original tricky bastard. Can we kind of get a sense of how difficult it is to get a grip on Odysseus? Karen, what do you reckon?
Well, I suppose you could... I suppose what's interesting about him is there's always a flip side, and that's like real life, so our strengths are our weaknesses. So if he's referred to as the Lord of the Liars in the text, sort of thinking about what that might mean now as a leader, do we want our great leaders to be lords of lying? Or does it sort of show us something else around flexibility, about being a survivor? There's always a sort of different way to view him, even if we're getting his side of the story. I think, you know, he does actually, he demonstrates his vulnerability, but yet is sort of constantly fighting against it and himself in that space.
He doesn't get great press in later Greek literature, does he? I mean, we think of him as this, you know, this very complicated, wily, travelling person. But by the time you get to the 5th century tragedy, he is a shit, basically.
Mm. I mean, in all of Greek tragedy, every one I can think of, he is always a villain, because what elevates him in the Odyssey, look, it's complicated, you know. As Emily Wilson has said, right, that's the way she chooses to translate the most famous adjective in all of Greek literature, which is the first adjective that's used of Odysseus in the Odyssey, polytropon, which means a man of many twists and turns, someone who turns things around, who has a twisty character, a twisty mind, who also follows a twisty route on his way home. But, you know, I always think it's important to emphasize that he is complicated, and that's part of his appeal. He is by no means admirable all the time, but sometimes he is. You know, my father, when he was sitting in on my first year university seminar on the Odyssey, which was one of the most insane experiences I've ever had, was constantly objecting and saying, you know, I don't see why this guy's supposed to be a hero. He's terrible, you know, and he is terrible in many ways, you know. But I think part of the genius of him as a character is that, like many charismatic people, he is both admirable and reprehensible. And look, one of the most interesting, you know, it's funny you think of him as the expat, because I always say, and perhaps even more sinisterly, he's the first anthropologist, and everywhere that he goes, he destroys. The catalog of the journeys of Odysseus, right? Everywhere he goes, he leaves heartbreak, destruction, and ruin in his wake.
So what's admirable about him, then?
Well, he is a charismatic character. I mean, he is inventive and funny and appealing. You know,
One shouldn't forget that he's occasionally faced by monsters who are trying to pull his head off, where a lie might be quite a good way of getting out of the particular position. I mean, he doesn't just lie for the habit of it in general, although it is very dear to his heart. I mean, he does need to do this. But I think one of the most interesting things about the text in terms of the complexity, he is the master trickster, but at the same time, the one person who tricks him is his wife. And what's fascinating about that is the way she tricks him, not with the famous trick of the bed that she says, pull out the bed in which we slept and we'll sleep there. And he says, who's moved my bed? How can it move? It can't be moved. It's built up. So that's the moment she recognizes him, when she's being least like himself, when he's actually being tricked. And what I find fascinating is a sense of how you might understand the complexity of not just one figure, but a figure in a relationship, is when are you most recognizable? When you're like yourself, or when you're being not like yourself? And I think that's a, you know, I think that's a really profound and interesting question about marriage.
All us middle-aged ladies will go away and read the Odyssey with new eyes, son.
And us middle-aged men.
And us lying, trickers bastards.
But, you know, you brought up women now, and I'm going to come to Madeline, because we've had Odysseus staying for 7 years with the most glorious nymph on the planet, and then eventually comes home to his wife. But in the sense, I mean, I got the feeling from your book that you, in a way, wanted to kind of somehow turn the tables on Odysseus and say, let's look at this story from the point of view of one of the women who are the well, victims, is putting it in some ways too strongly, but who are kind of what. Or Odysseus is foil. What happens if you look at it from the other way? And is that what you were wanting to do?
Yes, very much. And I'm going to pick up on what you were saying about Penelope, because I think that I absolutely agree that I think Homer demonstrates that she is more intelligent than her extremely intelligent husband, that this whole thing is about how intelligent Odysseus is, but actually, you know, she's the one who plays the final trick. And certainly she's more self-disciplined than he is. I'm not going to pile on Odysseus.
That wouldn't be difficult.
Sorry. I'm not going to pile on Odysseus. But you know, as you say, I think part of what makes him interesting is that ambivalence about him and the ambiguity in his character, the complexity. He blows up, he loses his temper, he makes terrible decisions. You know, all those things happen over the course of the poem. But what drew me in particular to kind of looking at it from Circe's perspective is that, you know, she, what an amazing character, the first witch in Western literature, who turns men to pigs. She seems to stand completely outside any sort of normal hierarchy that we're used to looking at. She is independent. She lives alone on her island with sort of her nymphs. She's not, you know, put into one of the traditional roles. She's not a mother, she's not a wife, and yet here comes Odysseus, and I sort of felt like her whole story, she goes from being this huge, amazing, really interesting character to just, you know, now you got to fit down into Odysseus's story. She has to be kind of regularized, and, you know, literally she kneels before him and sort of made smaller to serve his story. And, you know, it is his story. It's called the Odyssey. But, you know, I wanted to imagine what it would be like to sort of think about it being her story. How would her version of this story look? And as he, you know, turns her into this, as he sort of uses her narratively and actually, part of what he does is that, you know, she suddenly becomes this character who is, you know, she's an obstacle, of course, you know, he has to overcome her. Oh, this scary witch, I totally, you know, I defeated her, and then she really wanted to sleep with me, she's beautiful, and, you know, it's this whole story that is clearly he's spinning that really works for him. But these female characters also have their own perspective, and how would they look at this character? Would they pick up on that ambiguity in his character? I would say so.
There's one marvelous moment at the end of the Circe scene, is it's the only place that Odysseus forgets to go home. It's the only story where he has to be reminded by his men, you've got to go now.
Right. Clearly, clearly he did not have an iPhone 7. But I mean, I think one of the interesting things going on here, and it connects to this issue of the complexity of his identity is, and it relates to something you were saying before, that the Odyssey is interested in two concurrent phenomena that we know to be true from our own lives, which is we believe that there is an inner me. We have this sense of me. But as we also know, we change over time and through circumstances. And one of the ways you know, talking about how the first word of the Odyssey is man, so it is, to a large extent, like most Greek literature, a literature of a patriarchal society. What does it mean to be a man? That's what Greek literature is interested in, except Sappho. And one of the ways that his identity as a man is described or defined is through his relationships to women. And I think one of the reasons, and I must say that, you know, one way to look at his experience is that he is feminized as the Greeks saw it, because he's rendered powerless, he's rendered homeless, he is victimized, you know, so he comes home, one could argue, a richer character than when he left to go and fight in the Trojan War, precisely because we define ourselves both from this idea of a sort of interior core that's unchangeable, but also through our relationships, relationally, and I think the Odyssey is really brilliant about how that works.
One of the most extraordinary things in that, in all of Western literature, is when he meets the princess Nausicaa on the beach, and she's a beautiful young girl, and he wants to seduce her in a certain way, not to have sex, but just to get help. And he says, he talks to her about the wonders of the marriage she's about to have if she gets married. And he says there are three things a woman should want. And the first one, of course, is a man. Blah. The second one is a house. Blah. But the third one is more fascinating. He uses the Greek word homophrosyne. You should have like-mindedness with your husband. And that is the only time in all of Greek patriarchal literature where a male author says one of the things you want with a woman is to have the same sort of mental setup. Normally, you know, you can imagine what the standard terms are. You know, the man is intelligent, the woman is emotional, the man is rigorous, the woman is not. But this is the one time that you actually get an opportunity to say, you should be like, you should be together. And that's maybe, there you go, there's a bit of a return for Odysseus against all these attacks on him.
But in a sense, just to finish off with some real victims before we move on. Yeah. I mean, the bit of the poem that makes a lot of us feel the most uncomfortable is the fate at the end of the slaves, the serving women, female slaves in the palace of Odysseus, who've been not really fully willingly serving the suitors who want to marry Penelope, and they get slaughtered. I mean,
that's a survival activity in the whole construct of slavery, isn't it? That women have had to and continue to have to enact in order to survive. So in that sense, it's a deeply harsh outcome. And I mean, going back to what I was saying about the idea of whether he's moral or ethical, that's perhaps where the moral compass, to me, that's a sort of slip in the moral compass, whereas previously when he's lied to survive, because a great hideous creature wants to, you know, dismember him, then yes, of course we can forgive that. But I don't think, I mean, you know, in so many ways we're so, you know, when women falter, then it's oh my God, you know, I mean, imagine if Penelope had actually faltered, what would her fate have then been? And I just wanted to say, as sort of around this idea of you know, for me, hierarchically, what I found really interesting was that for a woman to match Odysseus with like-mindedness, she actually has to be superhuman. She has to be beyond the human. He gets to be immortal. He's a man. But to match him on that level, then, you know, are you a goddess? You know, it's Penelope notwithstanding. But, you know, it's that idea that somehow you've got to either have access to... you know, it's Athena who's his champion. And in fact, when I, in the piece that I wrote, I wanted to focus on his mother, Anticlea, which I found meant a sort of woman of no fame. That's sort of literally what her name means. So she has no fame. And when he goes to the underworld and he discovers his mother's dead, he didn't even know that. In the sort of 20 years that he's been away, and she dies pining for him. But he's like, no, can you hold on? Because I need to talk to Tiresias first. I've got to speak to the prophet. Hold on, Mum. Yeah, in a minute, I'll come to you. And I found that really You know, so those are the sort of kind of, I suppose, sort of fallibilities that we observe in him all the time.
And to pick up, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, to pick up on that idea of hierarchy that you're talking about, I also think it is important to remember that, you know, these are mostly aristocrats that we're talking about. And the gap, you know, the Odyssey actually features a couple slaves in prominent roles, you know, Eurycleia, Odysseus's nurse, and Telemachus's nurse, who she's actually the one who recognizes him based on a scar he has on his leg when she's washing his feet. But his reaction to her recognizing him is so brutal that he just comes back with this this rage, and you know it's clearly coming from he doesn't want her to blow the plan that he has created. But I think, you know, it's important to sort of keep in mind that those women, for example, the 12 maids that you mentioned, you know, they had no consent to give. And yet, you know, both in the Odyssey and in later translations, they have often been, you know, called whores and things like that.
But there...
One last point on this, and then we go on.
The murder of the slave women is also consistent with his treatment of many of the male suitors who are presented as nice characters. You know, they just wanted to marry Penelope. They didn't, you know, they thought he was dead. But, you know, several times at the end, you know, people will come up to him and say, well, don't kill me. I'm just some, you know, nice guy from Oxford or whatever. And I had no idea. The slaughter has to be total... And I think it's unabashed about...
Except for the poet and except for the seer. So he looks after the ones who are really good and who might write songs about him.
I personally love when he sees his mother in the underworld. I always say she is the first Jewish mother in world literature because he didn't know she died. And he's like, Ma, what are you doing here? And she said, well, you didn't call, you didn't write. Literally. Right.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
What I'd like to do now is just move us on a little bit. I mean, we've been talking about the complexity of the character of Odysseus and the complexity of manhood, in a sense. But one thing that always strikes me very forcibly, and Simon, in a sense, launched this in what he said, is the way that... It's not just the characters, that nothing is ever quite what it seems in the Odyssey. And you might think that what you've got here, particularly in the conflicts with the, quotes, barbarians on the margins of the world, that there's a very straightforward clash between civilization, good, represented by Odysseus, and barbarity, bad, that Odysseus, in a sense, justly... manages to either escape from or exterminate. And yet, when you look at any of these conflicts that Odysseus has, one of the things, you know, here we are right at the beginning of Western literature, and it is constantly taking the ground from under your feet. And there's one very famous episode that comes in, you know, every Tales from the Odyssey, and I'm fairly confident that you'll be hearing it later in the excerpts that are going to be performed, is when Odysseus actually drives the eye out of the cannibalistic giant Polyphemus, the one-eyed Cyclops, and manages cleverly to escape from the cave of the Cyclops by having his men cling to the bottom of Polyphemus's sheep. And Polyphemus, now blind, of course, can't see them, nor can he feel them as he pats his animals. Looks like, you know, told like that, looks like a really straightforward bit of, you know, Odysseus, Greek, civilized, versus giant, one-eyed barbarian who eats people. But even there, it's never as simple, even that story. I mean, you wrote about it in your memoir, Daniel.
Yeah, it's a very interesting. I mean, the Odyssey, it's, you know, again, we come to this issue of complexity, that nothing is straightforward. And in the Cyclops episode, you know, we all think of Cyclops as this monster, although, and one of the things that Emily Wilson does in her translation, she points out that actually the word man is used of the Cyclops. Mm-hmm. He's this terrible man. So it's never clear cut. It's never civilization versus barbarism, which, you know, when I was at university, that's how we sort of learned it, but it's much more complicated than that. And, you know, Odysseus, a great theme of the Odyssey, obviously, is hospitality. You know, the suitors are violating the hospitality of the palace, but he enters the Cyclops cave. You know, he criticizes the Cyclops for eating his men, not without reason. And but he has entered the Cyclops cave uninvited. That's why I think of him as the anthropologist, right? He just goes, he barges into these places. So no one ever talks about that. You know, he's the barbarian invader in the Cyclops' nice little house with his cheese and his milk and his sheep. He's not bothering anybody, you know. So it's all, I think one of the great things about the Odyssey is how hip it is to the complexities of the way we want to make it a simplistic opposition all the time between men and women, husbands and wives, Greek and barbarian, but it's always more complicated.
It's very important that when Odysseus comes in, he gets the Cyclops drunk. He gives him a false present. Yeah. He gives him a gift that makes him drunk. And then the Cyclops says, "What's your name?" And he gives him a false name.
And he lies.
And then he puts his eye out. You know, this is the failure of reciprocity is on both sides. And it's the way that works is a very, very important part of that story.
Then he can't resist, can he? Yeah. By saying, "Ah, you idiot. Ah, it wasn't really nobody. It was actually me." So I think that... Anyway, sorry.
One little extra point. I once saw a beautiful retelling of the Odyssey by a 7-year-old girl, the Cyclops episode. And it came to the famous joke where Odysseus said, he's asked his name and he says, "My name is No Man." And she didn't write very well, so she turned the letter upside down, so he said, "My name is Woman." I thought it was wonderful. Now there's a retelling.
In some ways, the nastiest bit, though, of that whole episode, I mean, well, there's plenty of nasty bits. I mean, Homer's description of the gouging out of the eye, and the sizzling that the steak makes.
The heat the steak, as it were.
Particularly repellent, you know. But it's the fact that in the end, Odysseus can't resist taunting him. Yeah. That is what is, you know, that he goes on and on. His men say, basically, "Shut up, you know, this, enough's enough."
And that's actually one of my favorite things about Odysseus is those failures of discipline in himself, and sort of those moments where he just, you know, he wants to assert himself and his fame. You know, I think oftentimes we talk about Achilles as being the one who is obsessed with fame, but Odysseus is very much interested in his own legend and his own sort of status in the world. He is the new best of the Greeks now that, you know, Achilles is dead. And I think the other thing, though, that those moments sort of bring out for me is we were talking about his identity, and, you know, he is a war hero. He has lived through 10 years of an appalling war. He brings about the fall of Troy and, you know, sacks of cities in the ancient world
were so ugly and so brutal. All the women, you know, and children taken captive, the men killed, everything sacked and burned. And so, you know, he's lived through that. He's lived through watching his men eaten by the Cyclops in front of his eyes. You know, so his reactions are also, I feel like he's been shaped by that. Yeah. And, you know, talking about how kind of he has to slaughter everyone at the end, I feel like this is also this outsize, you know, is he able to react with something other than violence, that, you know, he sort of keeps reaching for that.
But picking up from that, it's interesting that what distinguishes him throughout the narrative, except that notable exception, is precisely his ability to retain control, even in the most humiliating and degrading situations. And so I think sort of narratively that's meant, as it were, to justify the intensity of the explosions when it happened. You know, he has to disguise himself as a beggar in order to get back into his own palace, and people treat him like crap, and they insult him. So, you know, you feel that these explosions, when they happen, are, as it were, you know, sort of emotionally justified. They're satisfying in some way. They're ugly and terrible, but they don't come from nowhere. And
one of the marvelous things that Madeline just pointed out too is this idea also that Odysseus can never actually be at home. He can come home, but he has to leave. He has to keep traveling in some ways. And I think there's that sense that you can't imagine Odysseus having a quiet life.
Well, Tennyson got that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the whole
Tennyson
point
burn,
of Ithaca.
He would not, however, get very good marks on a leadership course, given that he is the only one of his whole party who actually gets home safely. Mm-hmm. All the other companions are dead by the end of the poem. And that's for me also, is a little bit of a problem.
My father said, well, I was in the army. He would never have made it in the army.
There's actually an American a psychiatrist who works with Vietnam veterans who's written a book called Odysseus in America that looks at exactly that. And he talks about, you know, how he would be court-martialed today if we were looking at him.
Now, in 5 minutes or so, we're hoping to just throw this open for discussion. But there's one point I wanted to raise before we did that, because I know I get a very strong feeling there are some people in the audience who know the Odyssey very well, but I also suspect there are some people who are about to give the Odyssey their first read. And we've been talking about its complexity, its heroism, the clashes of civilization and barbarity, or not. And I think all those are terribly important ways of understanding the Odyssey. But when you pick the Odyssey up now and you start to read it, there are kind of things which, even in the best translations, still somehow are liable to get in the way. You know, the repeated epithets that go with nouns, rosy-fingered dawn or whatever. But also the whole panoply of the divine apparatus, that the gods are somehow in control. And as we've mentioned, you know, there's the underworld. You know, Odysseus pays a visit to the place of the dead. And I think some people, when they read it first, those things do get in the way a bit. And Karen, you actually picked the going to the underworld section for your reworking of your episode of the Odyssey. So, why? You
know. Well, it was weird actually, because I'd written two books of poetry, very kind of elegiac poetry, and I thought, oh, I really want to get away from death. I don't want to deal with death anymore. And then I was like, oh, I have to actually respond to this part of it. But I think, to me, it's deeply fascinating, this idea that there's this very sort of thin veil between these two different realms, between the living and the dead, or the spirit that lives on in another dimension. And I love this idea of, you know, that you have to go through a lot of ritual, ceremony, sacrifice. You have to enact all of these things, but ultimately if you're thinking about it in terms of challenge, you know, what's the biggest obstacle if you want to communicate with someone? Well, actually, maybe that they're dead. That's going to be problematic. But, you know, that's a sort of, it's a sort of like a final frontier in a way that he goes through. And just for curiosity as well, I mean, if you could be to go to where we go, where we know we're definitely going, but we have no idea what it will be like. There's that factor to sort of be a tourist in that world.
Yeah. Do we have any tips in general for dealing with, say, the gods? How do we understand the gods in this poem? Because, you know, they pop up and they look kind of all-powerful, and you imagine them in kind of wearing sheets and...
always giving you beauty treatment. You know.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, well, I think it's interesting that we said the first word of the text is man. And the way you might want to understand the idea of what it is to be a human is in relation to what happens in terms of death or the possibility of some sort of sublimity, some sort of beyond. And after all, Odysseus, with Calypso, is offered immortality. The goddess says, just stay here with me. You can become like a god. You'll never die. And he actually says no to that. And he says no to permanent food. In fact, the two things you can't have enough of, life and food, right, in the ancient world. And he's offered them both, and he rejects them. And that's part of what makes this text interesting, is that he says, I want to go back to Ithaca because it's a harsh land but a fit nurse of men. So this idea, you know, you don't want the... So the immortality is a crucial part of this text because he wants immortal fame, but it's only by fame he can be immortal, or by his children he can be immortal.
But immortality is boring. You know, that's the problem of the Greek gods. And
we
one of the
know,
great,
Daniel
whatever else you say about Odysseus,
yeah.
He gives up the chance to have eternal life because he would rather have Ithaca and Penelope.
Yeah.
I have to say that's pretty good, you know. And it's meaningful because human life is meaningful because it has pain. Pain is... One of the great moments of the Odyssey is when we get this incredible series of flashbacks to the moment when, as a baby, Odysseus received his name, which is connected to the Greek word for pain. And it seems to say something essential about the human experience, and here I come back to complexity, that part of what gives life meaning is the fact that it ends. The gods are always bored. That's why they're always screwing around. You know, it's really boring, and I think that's incredibly moving, you know.
And they also tease and bully Odysseus. There's a very strange sense, if you come from a Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea that God is somehow going to go, ha, 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 you didn't recognize me.
Yeah.
So I think that is a problem for reading the Odyssey.
I think on that note, we really would love to throw this open to comments or questions in the audience. And the lights are coming up. And I believe we've got some roving mics. And we're going to take... I haven't got my glasses on, which makes this a bit more of a challenge than usual. But we're going to take, say, a group of three questions at first, and then put those to the panel, and then have another three, just so we can have more. So... with the roving mic, as I said, I don't have my glasses, so the roving mic, please pick somebody with their hand up.
And
the briefer, the better. Mm. Not that we've always been brief, but...
No epic questions.
No, this is not an epic question, yes.
Hi, everyone on the panel has spoken quite a lot about victims and collateral damage and how there's quite a lot of collateral damage caused as Odysseus travels, some of it more necessary than others maybe. I haven't read the original Greek because Greek is really hard, but I was wondering if in the original... I was wondering if in the original language there's a sense of sort of mourning this damage and this loss of life, or if it's gleeful about the excitement and destruction and war is fun, or how much it mourns that.
Thanks. Can we have just two more, and then we'll have another round after we've responded to these. As I say, I can't see the hands.
Hello. Can I speak?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Sorry. You said there was no Homer, so who wrote it?
Thank you. Do you know, I told Simon, as we were talking before, he said, what kind of questions would you like me to get? I predicted that one. If Homer didn't exist, who wrote the Odyssey? can we have just one more? As I say, I can't see hands.
Hi. I was wondering why you think it is that there's never been a really good film made of the Odyssey. Right.
Yeah, and that's certainly the case, isn't it? Okay. Can we start with... let's start with who's Homer, Simon, Professor of Greek at University of Cambridge. If Homer didn't exist, who wrote the Odyssey? And can we have another of your kind of one-minute brilliant summations? Okay. Because we could be
the
here for a very
is,
long time.
Whoever she was, we don't know. Right? there are two basic theories, right? Quite simply. One is that there's an oral tradition which produces poetry by a series of bards going round, and the stories gradually accrete and get better and incremental till they get to the stage they're in. And at a certain point, probably in the 5th century, they were, well, the end of the beginning of the 6th century, they were tied down and they became pretty well a fixed text. And therefore, to talk about a single author is a mistake. The other theory is that there was some sort of monumental bard, one bard or two bards, who was so brilliant within this oral tradition that it was his version that went ahead. And people have been arguing about this since the Renaissance. There's no answer. And from as far as I'm concerned, we've got a pretty solid text. Why don't we read and talk about it?
Now, reading and talking about it, let's think just very quickly about the original language. I mean, does... If we're thinking about victims, collateral damage, and the kind of violence of it, does the Greek do something different?
Well, I'm going to answer this a little bit in sort of relationship to the Aeneid, for instance, where the idea of collateral damage is built into sort of Virgil's thesis statement, where he says, you know, of such a weight it was to found the Roman race. Founding the Roman race was this heavy thing. It was heavy for Aeneas, and it was heavy for all the people that he sort of steps on along the way that have to get kind of ground up in this progress to empire. And I think also, in comparison sort of to the other, to the Iliad, you know, I think that Homer, or whoever it is, the storyteller, the storytelling sensibility, it is so clear that, you know, I don't really think you can call the Iliad a pro-war poem, because we see in such intimate detail what it does to men's bodies. And when you are reading it in the Greek, you learn all the parts for the internal organs, because there is so much, you know, exploding of brains and sort of spirit through the heart. And I think that there is some of that in the Odyssey as well, that, you know, we see what violence does and what it does to physical bodies, what it does to humans who are not gods, who are not protected by their immortality up on Mount Olympus. And so I think in that sense, there is sort of a space for them in the poem, but we also have to sort of make sure we see that.
There's also something else. I think it just has to be quickly said, that the Odyssey is filled with tears. It is a poem in which, as you know from reading my book, was the other thing my father hated about the Odyssey. It was like, I was in the army, nobody cried. You know, everybody is crying, especially Odysseus. And let me quickly say that part of the climactic couple of books of the Odyssey is this incredibly wonderful scene in the underworld, where the ghosts of the suitors have all gone. And there's a wonderful exchange between the ghost of Agamemnon and the ghost of Achilles, and each one is telling the other what a great funeral he got, and it, which in a way sort of buries the Iliad at the end of the Odyssey. So I think it's a poem that is extremely worried about mourning. You know, I think it is attuned to that.
Then the final question of that three was, you know, great epic poem. Why not great epic movie? Why is it? Why have movies of the Odyssey always been, sorry if anybody involved is here, so dreadful?
Well, I think that idea, though, of I just want to go back to that idea of this reading from the original and the idea around translation. And Emily Wilson, you know, talks in the introduction to her translation about this idea that, you know, are you being faithful to this kind of weird sort of notion of some idealized purity of the original, that it's such a pure thing? And what is that thing that you're really trying to say nothing else can ever match, ever? And I think that that in itself is a bit of a skewed idea. And then thinking about it, if you think of it as a collaborative text, there's still lots of collaborative writing that happens today, and that is going to bring me around to the film bit. So if you, maybe there's never been a good film of The Odyssey, but is Game of Thrones a collaborative kind of version? Is that a very loose version of The Odyssey with multiple authors, and that actually the box set now is our kind of great epic poem? That could maybe speak to that.
I'll give you one answer to the question, and I've seen pretty well every film of The Odyssey that's been made, and I agree with you, they're all terrible. But if you wanted a little icon of terribleness, I would go for the siren scene. Famous moment in The Odyssey when he has to go past the sirens who sing him a song. Every single film of The Odyssey makes that song about sex. They say, come here, we're beautiful, it's sexy, come here. Right? Because that's how Hollywood and most filmmakers think. In Homer, they say, come here, we know everything. We offer you knowledge. All right? And I think the difficulty is that The Odyssey, the people who make films about The Odyssey, don't understand it's complicated. If they've come across it as a child, they think of it as a childish text, and they turn it into a childish story. I'm afraid that just doesn't work. I had the great pleasure of being a reviewer for the Evening Standard of the film Troy.
I reviewed Troy, that too.
Troy, we all reviewed that.
Troy opened the same day across the world, so everybody went in to review it at the same time. And as I went in, they asked me to sign a waiver that I would not reveal the plot.
Well, right. A thing to be said.
Shock.
Very
Troy
quickly.
Falls.
A thing to be said very quickly about why these adaptations are so terrible is the plot of The Odyssey is extremely convoluted. You know, it moves around in time and space, and it starts in the year 20, but then it goes back in time. And every version I've seen, that terrible Armand Assante one, with, however, Isabella Rossellini as Athena, Pamal, is that they start at the birth of Telemachus. You know, they tell it in order, which is very boring. You know, its interest derives from its convoluted quality.
Right. Mm. I think we've got time for just one more trio of questions, with brief questions and brief answers. Mm. Again, if you've got the mic in your hand, speak.
I was just wondering what you thought of Odysseus's men's attitude towards him, because if I remember right, I haven't read it in a long time, but they disobey him quite directly on a couple of occasions by opening the bag of winds, for example, and Hyperion's cattle, if I'm right. Mm-hmm. But obviously he's led them to victory in the Trojan War, so he's obviously not trusted entirely, but still, you know, their king and their hero, so I wonder what your opinion was on that.
Thanks. We can just get two more.
Hello. Considering the near barbarity that Odysseus can display, would you personally consider him worthy of the title hero?
Right. And one more.
So Madeline's mentioned a bit about the Iliad. So would you say that there are kind of two extremes when you compare Achilles as a hero and Odysseus as a hero? Can you find what makes a Greek hero in either of the texts or in some sort of middle ground?
Thanks very much. This will keep them busy for the next 3 minutes. Can we just start with Odysseus's men's attitudes to him? Anybody?
Mistakes were made.
On both sides. They also told him to leave the Cyclops cave.
Well, it goes to the complexity of the character, because we know from the Iliad, since we're going to be weaving in the Iliad now, that he is one of the real heroes of the Iliad and is a commander and an effective warrior. Mm. But he, you know, one must say that what one knows of him as a leader in the Odyssey is problematic, to say the least. Not least that he manages to lose all, how many men were? Hundreds and hundreds of men. But they constantly rebel against him. They don't trust him. They don't believe what he says. So that's interesting. I don't know what the answer is, but it's telling us something about the difficulties he has being a leader.
But the question of the hero, one sentence on the hero?
The last two questions, in a sense, are about the same kind of thing, about the barbarity. Does that mean he's hard to call him a hero? And what about the different versions of hero that you see in the Iliad and the Odyssey? If we can have a couple of sentences, otherwise I shall get terribly told off if we go on too late.
Right, okay. One sentence answer. Okay, a hero is not someone about whom we sing, he's got to be strong and he's got to be tall and he's got to be whatever, you know, he's a hero. That is not what a Greek hero is, right? A Greek hero is someone who crucially goes too far. And going too far is both transcendence and transgression. And you can't have one without the other in Greek.
Would anybody like to add anything to that pithy summation,
what you want
Professor Goldhill?
Well, 2 minutes for the Odyssey, 1 minute for...
Karen, just you're looking tempted. Oh. 1 minute, temptation. 1 minute, and then I close.
I suppose it, to me, I was just thinking about how that connects to the idea of home. You know, he wants to go home, but then he doesn't want to be at home, and home is a place, home is himself, you know, and I think, I was thinking about that thing, what's a hero, and is it just this idea of action, the action hero, does he have to do things to get things done? I mean, Penelope doesn't get to be the hero, why? Because she stays in one place, doing a repetitive action. She's clever, but that's what she does. He travels, and he transcends time and space in that way. So in a sense, I agree, but just with home as this sort of proviso.
There's actually a wonderful Dorothy Parker poem that's just about that sort of contrast between Odysseus and Penelope, and it's Penelope speaking. It's, the poem is called Penelope, and she says, you know, he's going to go out, and he's going to ride the silver wave, and he's going to be out there in the sea. I'm going to sit at home and rock, you know, answer my neighbor's knock on the door. I'm going to do the laundry, and they will call him brave. And it sort of ends with this, you know, complete puncturing. Yeah.
That's a great point on which to end. I'd just like to say, thank everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank all the panelists, who I won't name again. And just to say that I think all of us will be signing books in the book-selling area here, wherever that is, but I'm sure that we can all find it. We hope to see you there. And if you've got any quick questions you want to put to us individually, that would be a good time to do it. So thank you very much indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.